WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The pace of executions in America has been mounting ever since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. The Supreme Court has made it more difficult for death row prisoners to appeal their cases. We're only halfway through 1992, and there have already been more executions this year than in all of 1991. This makes the work of my guest very difficult and unpopular. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer who represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. He's the founding director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. Stevenson says he realizes that most Americans support the death penalty, but even they should be concerned about the racial bias with which it is administered. Stevenson grew up in rural Delaware and graduated from Harvard Law School. He told me how he was first exposed to death row.
It was almost 10 years ago when I went to Atlanta, Georgia, to work with a group called the Southern Prisoners Defense Committee. As a law student, I took a course at Harvard Law School in race and poverty litigation, and one of the requirements of the course was that you go to an organization doing public interest litigation. I went to Atlanta and spent a month there, and it was really a very engaging, very overwhelming experience for me because I met death row prisoners and I encountered the reality of death penalty litigation in this country, and I was very, very affected by it. I think what was most challenging to me was that there were all these people, many of whom reminded me of the folks I grew up with, who were on death row, unable to get adequate legal representation. And it became very clear to me that these folks had very, very severe problems, obviously awaiting execution, that were almost entirely dependent on entirely dependent on lawyers to solve those problems, and they weren't getting the help they needed.
Why weren't they getting the help they needed?
Well, there is no right to counsel for anyone once they've been convicted and sentenced to death and their case has been appealed to the state appellate court. There is no longer a right to counsel, so that we now have close to 2,600 people on death row in this country, all of whom will have no right to legal assistance once their case has been reviewed by one appellate court. So that if their case is to be challenged in federal courts or in subsequent appeals, they must rely on lawyers to volunteer their services to provide them with the representation that they need.
So here you were, it was your first time on death row. You saw these problems, but what made you think this was your work?
Well, my image of what a lawyer is was really framed as a kid growing up in southern Delaware. I grew up in a rural community. And I never really met any lawyers as a young kid. I never really met any lawyers until I got to law school. So I didn't really have a sense of who they were and what they were, but I did have an image that really was shaped by the civil rights movement. I knew that it was lawyers who came into southern Delaware and made Brown versus Board of Education applicable to the public school system in my community. I knew that it took lawyers to open up the public schools for little black kids like me. And I also had some appreciation that but for the work of lawyers to challenge society, to do things that society didn't want to do, to represent people who didn't have the means or resources to obtain representation, I wouldn't have had an opportunity to graduate from high school and go on to law school because Brown was just that critical to my development. So that idea that a lawyer was someone who really sort of stood with people who needed legal representation, the person who could make a difference for disadvantaged people, people with very, very unpopular problems, was really what framed my understanding of who a lawyer is and what motivated me to go to law school.
You know, I bet a lot of people, though, think or say to you that, you know, as an African-American lawyer, you'd be doing a better service to the African-American community, trying to work with people who you were convinced were innocent, or maybe trying to prosecute drug dealers who were terrorizing neighborhoods. as opposed to working with people on death row whose cases, A, might be hopeless, and B, you might be representing people who are guilty anyway?
Well, I think, you know, it has always been true that because there are so few African-American lawyers in the society generally, and the problems in the African-American community are so diverse and so complex, there's always an argument that your time could be better spent serving some other part of the community or dealing with some other problem. But I think there is something quite important about standing with the people who need legal assistance the most. And there's certainly no question that in this society, people who have been accused of very serious crimes, very horrible crimes, and the people who have been convicted and sentenced to death are the people who are perhaps the most despised, the most rejected, the most hated in our society. And I think that anyone, African-American or other, that chooses to stand with these people and say, no, even these folks are entitled to legal representation, even these people are entitled to equal justice and fair representation and fair review of their cases. By doing that, I think that we create some hope and opportunity for other folks who are also in need and are also not getting the assistance that they so desperately deserve.
How do you decide whose case to take on?
Well, it's not that difficult for us. We represent or are involved in providing assistance to everyone on death row in Alabama. We try to recruit lawyers for the folks on death row that we can, and anyone who we can't recruit a lawyer for, we step in and provide representation. So basically, if we can't find another lawyer, a firm, or someone to provide pro bono assistance, then we end up taking the case.
Now, what are you usually trying to do, prove a prisoner's innocence or just trying to prevent their execution?
Well, I think what we end up doing in death penalty litigation in this era is just trying to get them a fair trial. I mean, most of the cases that we work on are cases where the evidence of unfairness is quite overwhelming. That is, many of these people do not get adequate legal representation at the trial level. They may have been represented by lawyers who did not meet with them before the trial, who did not do any investigation into the mitigating factors that are important for a jury's decision as to whether they live or die. They may not have evaluated the state's evidence or investigated the case very adequately. Then there are other issues. Racial bias and racial discrimination is a very prominent feature of the way in which the death penalty works in this country, and challenging that is an important part of the kind of representation that we provide. A lot of people on death row have mental health issues, mental health problems, and explaining what those problems are and getting courts to deal honestly with what it means to be mentally retarded or mentally ill in the course of one of these crimes or one of these cases is another part of what we might try to do. But all in all, yes, we're trying to establish that the person was not properly convicted of the crime. And in some cases where the evidence of guilt is overwhelming, you may be just talking about whether the person is properly subject to the death penalty.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson. He's the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. This is a group that represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. When you're working with prisoners on death row, do you always find things in the prisoners who ask you to represent them? Do you always find things to like or to respect about them? Or are there times when you're working with someone who you really think is just, you know, a horrible and frightening, terribly dangerous person?
You know, I think when we say we're going to execute someone, what we're really saying is that this person's life has no purpose, this person's life has no value, this person is beyond redemption. And in my experience in working with death row prisoners, I've just never encountered that person. Every client I've ever had has convinced me or shown me enough humanity that I think his life is worth sparing, that his life still has some value, his life still has some purpose. No question, he's got to be punished if he's guilty of a crime that tragically ended another person's life. But no, I've never had any difficulty finding something human, something redeeming, something purposeful in the lives of my clients. And, you know, I think the notion of who is the death row prisoner is one that's not clearly understood. I think we have images of Charles Manson and, you know, Hollywood versions of the mastermind criminal who kills and kills like, you know, you and I eat potato chips or something as the typical death row prisoner. And in fact, that's not who is ending up on death row in this country because of the problems with racial bias, because of the problems with adequate legal representation. Many of the people who end up on death row are people that you and most of your listeners know. They're on the streets, they're young kids, they're folks who are struggling and get into a difficult situation and tragically commit a crime that results in death. But they're not so different from the people I grew up with. They're not so different from a lot of people in this society who are struggling and struggling to try to kind of stay on this side of the fence. And I never have any difficulties in dealing with my clients and seeing some purpose in their lives, some meaning and something useful about keeping them alive.
Do you see part of your role as a lawyer representing prisoners on death row as providing comfort in the hours before execution if they are facing imminent execution?
Well, I think, I do think it's important for, I believe in the human, I guess if I believe that there's something redemptive or something purposeful in their lives, I need to show that, and I want them to understand that I believe it. I think too many people end up on death row because they feel like nobody cares about them, that the system, it doesn't make a difference whether they tell the truth about what happened. It doesn't make a difference if they try to explain. It doesn't make a difference if they try to show the jury that they really do still have something to offer. And it's important for me that my clients understand that that's not an issue as far as I'm concerned, that I do want to see them live. And I think, if society's going to execute these people in our name, that is, in the name of the people of the state of Alabama, or the people of Pennsylvania or whatever, everybody has an equal investment in that. But yes, it is important. And it's sometimes difficult. There's no question that when I was in law school and I was growing up, I'm not sure anything prepared me for some of the difficult moments that I've had in providing representation to people on death row. Certainly going down and spending the last 15 minutes with someone before he's executed, before a guard comes up and says, you got to leave now so we can shave his body to put him in the electric chair. Or dealing with all of the issues that come around those experiences is certainly difficult, and I'm not sure anything formally prepares you for that. But I think it's important that you be prepared to be a witness to everyone's humanity, which is what I see myself as trying to be.
What have you found you were capable of saying to someone who is facing death in 15 minutes that wouldn't be of a kind of easy, comforting cliche? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting. I think most death row prisoners are in such desperate need of, committed and capable legal representation that you end up not saying much at all. I mean, your clients end up doing most of the talking to you. I think because they're grateful that someone had the courage or had was willing to stand with them when it seems like everyone else is standing against them. And most of my clients are just very appreciative of any legal representation that they can get, and like to use that time trying to express that more so than you're trying to prepare them for something.
Mm-hmm. Do you sit in on the execution?
I have not in the cases that I've been involved in that have resulted in executions, but that just depends on the case, the client, and the circumstances.
Why have you so far decided not to?
It was not something that either client deemed necessary or important or wanted me to do, so I didn't.
So you've had, two clients then?
We got
executed.
We got involved in two cases very late in the stage. One we got involved 2 weeks before scheduled execution, and one we got involved in the case about a month before a scheduled execution. In both of those cases, we were unable to get a stay of execution, and those clients were executed.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson, the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center, a group which represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian Stevenson. We're talking about his work representing prisoners on Alabama's death row. Can you give us an example of something specific that made you feel really discouraged?
Mm-hmm. There have been some very difficult moments in the last 8 years of when I've been representing death row prisoners. But I really think when I think about the most difficult moment, it was actually when I was reading a decision from the United States Supreme Court back in 1987. In 1987, the Supreme Court held in a case called McCluskey versus Kemp that even though he had presented statistical evidence that you're 11 times more likely to get the death penalty in the state of Georgia if the victim is white than if the victim is black, that you're 22 times more likely to get the death penalty if the defendant is black and the victim is white, that he was not entitled to relief under a claim that racial bias had undermined or contributed to the death sentence in his particular case. And the court said two things in that decision which were very, very discouraging to to me. I mean, the first thing the court said was, well, if we start dealing with racial bias and sentencing in the death penalty context, it's just a matter of time before lawyers come back and start complaining about racial bias and sentencing in burglary offenses or drug offenses or property offenses and other crimes. That's what Justice Brennan termed this fear of too much justice, which led the court away from responding to the evidence presented by McCleskey. The second thing the court said was even more discouraging. The court said that certain disparities based on race, in effect, a certain amount of racial discrimination in the criminal justice system is inevitable. And that was the word used by Justice Powell writing for the majority. And I thought about that in the context of my own life. In 1954, the Supreme Court could have said that racially segregated school systems are inevitable. White parents don't want their kids going to school with black kids. We've got economic and other barriers to getting equal opportunities for black kids to get a high school degree. And it's just an inevitable feature of this society. But the court didn't say that. They said it was unconstitutional, and its unconstitutionality made it not inevitable. The court didn't say it in the criminal justice system, again, because I think we have this view that when we're talking about people who have been accused of criminal conduct, it's okay to discriminate. It's okay to tolerate gross evidence of racial bias. That was the most discouraging thing for me because it really sort of accepted this idea that we can allow racial bias, we can concede defeat to racial discrimination, racial injustice in the society if we're just talking about the right kind of people, if we're just talking about people unpopular enough that nobody will get mad when we do it. And I think more than dealing with some, difficult executions and seeing some really serious problems go uncorrected, that decision was very, very, very discouraging because it really does symbolize, and here's this court with equal justice under the law and scrawled on its building, in effect, conceding defeat to a very, very disturbing reality that surrounds this criminal justice system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Stevenson. We're talking about his work representing prisoners on Alabama's death row. Could you physically describe for us what death row is like in the prisons of Alabama?
Well, it varies. There are three prisons in my state that have folks under sentence of death. We have five women under a death sentence, and they're kept at the women's prison. Most death row prisoners in this country are kept in pretty much total seclusion. Many of them spend 23 hours a day in their cells. They're let out for less than an hour each day for a shower or for some walk around the yard or recreation. There are many times when you don't even get that 1 hour out. So it's a pretty isolated, pretty bleak existence. They're not allowed to integrate with other prisoners so that unlike perhaps other prisoners in society that have an opportunity to kind of get to know other folks in the prison or meet people who kind of come from their part of the state or part of the community or whatever, death row prisoners are kind of isolated from most of those contacts.
When you're meeting with a death row prisoner who isn't exposed to other people because they're not let out of the cell and they're in solitary confinement, if they've been there a long time, is it hard for them in a way to hold a conversation with you because they're just not used to it?
No, I think the more difficult thing for them is that there's so much that they want to talk about. There's so many needs that they want to address. There's so many problems that they need to confront that there just doesn't seem to be enough time to do it all in one attorney visit. And you have to understand that many of the folks on death row don't get visits from anyone but their attorneys, and some of them don't even get regular visits from them. And one of the things that struck me when I first did this work was meeting someone on death row who told me when I went down to see him that I was the first person that he, that came to visit him in over 3 years. And obviously when you haven't had a chance to talk to anybody, in person for that amount of time, there's a lot of stuff that comes out that you want to talk about, and it's kind of hard to do it all at one time.
Have you had to learn how to say no because of the demands on your time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think anybody who gets involved in the criminal justice system learns that if you're prepared to really make a difference, if you're prepared to make a commitment and really sort of stand with people, the demands are going to be overwhelming. You'll get that very quickly because it's just so many needs. So yes, you absolutely have to learn to say no. And it's a difficult thing when you see people who have very, very serious problems, who need legal assistance but cannot get it. And, knowing that you could provide it if there was just enough time in the day is difficult. But in fairness to your other clients, you just have to.
So what do you say, in fairness to my other clients, I have to say no?
Sure. I mean, I think about it, you know, we've got lots of kids, who have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. I mean, some of these cases are very, very sad to me because, you know, we've got 14-year-olds who are indicted for capital murder in the state of Alabama. What they then decide to do after they've been indicted for capital murder is to plead guilty to the capital crime and accept a sentence of life imprisonment without parole, just so they can avoid the death penalty. And many of these kids are, in my view, not legally responsible for the crime. They were, you know, outside in the car while somebody else went in a store and killed someone and whatnot. And you could I could have a lot of problems with whether it's appropriate that they get that kind of sentence at the age of 14 for that kind of behavior, particularly when some of them have no prior criminal record, et cetera. But because we sort of work just in the death penalty area, it makes it very difficult to, you know, take the time away and say, well, I'll step in and try to provide you representation. And that's very difficult because you see that problem and you know that it's an unjust situation.
You've seen a range of people in solitary on death row facing death. What's the range of effects you've seen it have on personality?
Well, I think, you know, for many people, it's very demoralizing and it becomes difficult for them to just sort of hang in there. I mean, the suicide rate among death row prisoners is very, very, very high. For other people, and I think this is sad and sort of ironic, for the first time, they have an opportunity to kind of really sort of think about what they're doing in ways where they're not being distracted by just a devastating drug addiction or by, you know, the burdens and the responsibilities of trying to survive on the streets. And some of those people experience growth, if you can imagine. But I think for everyone, it's very, very, very difficult just to kind of know that at any point you're going to be hauled out of your cell and strapped in an electric chair and kind of burned to death. I mean, I think that reality makes it emotionally difficult for anyone under sentence of death. But, you know, that's something that you just have to deal with. I mean, when someone commits a terrible crime, they're going to be punished, and that punishment is going to include, obviously, some discomfort, some difficulty. And I don't think that's illegitimate. I think that's reasonable, and I think that's responsible. The question is, what kind of punishment? And obviously, that's where we spend most of our time addressing our concerns.
Brian Stevenson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Stevenson is the executive director of the Alabama Capital Representation Resource Center. This is a group that represents prisoners on Alabama's death row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.